Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 92, recorded February 27th, 2013. Cory Doctorow. Triangulation is brought to you by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for an exclusive 50 free stock media files, go to pond5.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we cover, actually talk to, converse with, interact with, great minds, people who are thinking deep thoughts, who are writing great things. It's always a pleasure for me because I get to pick the people we get to talk to. And today, an old friend, a great friend, and a guy who's a total inspiration, Cory Doctorow, joins us on Triangulation. He is on a book tour for his newest book, which is a sequel to Little Brother, which was incredible. It's called Homeland. And he's somewhere in the center of the United States. He's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Cory.
Oh, hey there. How are you?
City 21 out of 24.
Yeah.
But we were saying before we started, it's very unusual for publishers to do book tours anymore. This is unheard of.
Yeah, they really believe in this. In fact, this is like the third tour they've sent me on in the last 6 months because I've had a whole ton of books out. I had Rapture of the Nerds out with Charlie Strauss, and we did like a little Northeastern tour. And then I had a six-week tour for Pirate Cinema in September, October. And now I'm on a four-week but 23-city tour. So it's pretty intense.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, it's working. The Homeland just hit the New York Times bestseller list for the third week running.
Awesome. Just like Little Brother. That's great.
Yeah.
So this is a young adult book.
It is.
But I hate to even say that because everybody I talk to, every adult I talk to loved Little Brother and loves Homeland and doesn't think of it as a young adult book at all.
So I think young adult literature is best understood as books that a young adult librarian can shelve without getting fired. It doesn't mean that they are books that only young adults can enjoy. Exactly. It means that they are books that are age appropriate for young adults. But things that are age appropriate for young adults aren't age inappropriate for older adults.
No, in fact, both of these books, Little Brother and Homeland, deal with some pretty heavy topics, terrorism, economic collapse. They're a little dystopian. It's not happy-go-lucky.
Well, there's Burning Man, too.
There's Burning Man. And that's not something – I'm surprised the librarian – that's such a young adult.
Yeah.
Do you go to Burning Man? You don't go to Burning
Man. Yeah, I do. You know, I've only just started going pretty recently, last couple, 3 years. And funnily enough, when I lived in San Francisco, I never went, despite the fact that it would have been very easy, because the World Science Fiction Convention always conflicted with it. And my wife talked me into going on our joint 40th birthday a few years back. And we had such a good time camping out with our friends from Liminal Labs, who are people I know from San Francisco, that it basically convinced me that from now on I'm pretty much blowing off the World Science Fiction Convention every year.
Wow.
if it happens to conflict.
But you're not bringing Posey yet.
Not yet. No, this is kind of a grown-up holiday from the kids. So the way that it usually works is I fly to Toronto with Posey and have some time with her family, leave her there with my parents, and then meet Alice in Vegas, and then we head on to Burning Man.
So do you recommend, does somebody need to read Little Brother before they read Homeland, or does it stand on its own?
No, you know what I did with Homeland, I tried to approach it the way that you would approach like the backstory of an alien civilization in science fiction. Good science fiction doesn't start with like a biography of the world that you're in. Instead, it drops in little hints, what the writer Jo Walton, she calls it in-cluing, where you just clue the reader in with little hints about what's gone on before. So I treat Homeland as kind of the fictional world. Or rather, Little Brother is kind of the fictional world from which Homeland is derived, and add little bits and pieces that kind of help you figure out what happened in it. If you've read Little Brother, there are some Easter eggs. There's some, you know, it's probably more fun. Yeah, but you don't have to have read Little Brother. It's definitely a standalone sequel.
I like that phrase, in-cluing.
Yeah. Joe's very clever. Joe wrote, I think, one of the best novels about science fiction, if not a science fiction novel, in many, many years called Oh, gosh.
I have it on like my Audible. I downloaded it. Somebody told me.
It won the World Fantasy.
Among
Others.
Among Others. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, who was it was telling me that you've got to read this. It's not science fiction. It's about science fiction.
Yeah, that's right. It's a fantasy novel about science fiction.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's on my list. Do you put these on audiobooks?
I try. All of them except for that one, Random House did audio on. But the thing is that I won't allow them to be released without DRM,
right?
With DRM. And 90% of the market is controlled by a company that requires DRM of its authors, and that's unfortunately it's Audible.
Right.
And so since they won't let me release my works without DRM, we don't sell through them. And I guess Random House felt like it was too much of a bite to take to give up 90% of the market because they're not doing it for this one. But, you know, we did that very successful Humble Bundle last time around with Pirate Cinema and the ebooks. And I've been talking with them about a Humble audiobook bundle. And I think if we did that, I would privately commission an audiobook of Homeland for the bundle.
Well, call me. I'd love to do it. With you.
Really? You know, I was thinking of Will Wheaton, actually, but you'd be awesome.
He's a bigger celebrity, though. You get Will Wheaton to do it.
Well, I just think he'd have the right voice for
a
teen.
It's a younger voice, exactly.
I
could be the old man. You got an old man, I'll be the old man.
There's an old man in there. Both of them, both you and he have read my work aloud, and you've both done amazing work with it. Yeah.
It's really fun to read out loud because it's very natural. It flows very beautifully, and you write so beautifully. Tell me a little bit about... Is this a future you worry about in Little Brother and now in Homeland?
Yeah, you know, I think we're about to invent a future. And in that future, either our computers will do what we say. Their default posture will be, yes, master. Or computers will try and push us around and their default posture is going to be, I can't let you do that, Dave. Because there are so many different entities, so many groups of people who really think that it would be better if your computer didn't do exactly what you asked it to, if it prevented you from doing some things that would cause some harm, like saving a DVD to your hard drive or saving a stream or playing an app in a platform other than Apple's or loading an app that Apple didn't bless into Apple's platform. They're just like there's this kind of emergent conspiracy of different interests that all want computers to hide things from their owners and to enforce policy against their owners. And that's growing and growing at speed. And my fear is that you can't really make a computer a little bit pregnant. Once you rejig it so that it's designed to hide things from its owners and betray them, betray their interests, then other people will figure out how to add more horrible ways of betraying you. Just like when in Germany, the Bavarian government got caught sneaking spyware onto the computers of people they wanted to keep an eye on. It was an illegal wiretapping measure. And the Chaos Computer Club discovered this spyware. They called it the Bundestrojaner or State Trojan. And what they found was that after your computer was infected with the Bundestrojaner and had the spyware that allowed the covert operation of the camera and the microphone and access to the hard drive and so on over the internet, that anybody could insert themselves into it. You could go to like a Starbucks and find other people who had been infected using a network scanner, and then you could kind of ride piggyback on the police and the government and spy on those people too. And once you start designing computers to hide things from their owners, it just never stops, I think.
Well, and who trusts the government? I mean, yeah, sure, bad guys could get access to it, but you don't trust the government to do it either.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I think it's important to note that even if you did trust the government, that this wouldn't be an effective way for the government to surveil people, right? Because, you know, just like in the 1990s, AT&T ran all of its Kalia interception hardware off a Sunbox. So that's the hardware that police departments use if they have a warrant for a wiretap. After the 1990s, after the passage of a law called Kalia, they didn't have to go down to the central office and affix a tap to a switch. Instead, Kalia mandated that switches would have back doors, that you could have a computer you'd log into with the police login. And then after that, you could wiretap any number. You could do pen traces or eavesdropping on any number. And the Kalia box that AT&T ran through the 90s was totally compromised. Organized crime used it. Hackers used it. And so what that meant is that as soon as you added a back door to the phone network was backdoored. Right. And there's like not really any two ways around that. Right. You can't backdoor something and then not have it be backdoored in the same way that In Greece, they don't actually turn on the Kalia interception stuff. They don't have a Kalia law, but all the switches they buy are designed for sale in the U.S. market, and so they have the Kalia backdoor. And during the Athens Olympic bid, some party unknown, presumably a government actor, snuck into their switch, their major switches, and turned on their Kalia stuff and used that to listen in on conversations all the way up to the prime minister's office.
Wow.
In the same way, you know, when Google got hacked in China and the Chinese government intercepted all that Gmail, that Gmail from dissidents, they used the lawful interception backdoor for that too. Like, it's like a tautology, right? You can't make a computer more secure by adding a backdoor.
Right, right. We're talking to Cory Doctorow. His newest book, Homeland, just came out. It's in hardcover. It's available everywhere. It's definitely a great read, especially if you want to go to Burning Man without getting dusty.
I don't know how you do that.
And, well, you know what? It's so accurate, you feel dusty. And at the end, there's an afterword, kind of poignantly, by Aaron Schwartz.
Yeah.
In which he says, this stuff is real. Did you know Aaron?
Yeah, I knew Aaron for more than half his life.
Yeah.
When I lived in San Francisco and Aaron was a 14-year-old contributing to RSS, my then-girlfriend, the very nice and lovely Lisa Rhine, had volunteered to be his chaperone when he came to San Francisco for face-to-face meetings. She was involved in W3C standard settings. And so she used to pick him up at the airport. And since I was her boyfriend, we'd go out with him together and we'd drive him around town and we'd take him, you know, to meet people. And we'd take him out to restaurants and marvel at his horrific eating habits. He only ate white food. We'd only French fries and boiled potatoes and like pizza with nothing on it and yogurt and white toast and steamed rice, but not fried rice because it wasn't white enough. And, you know, you could listen to him talk while he was eating this horrible diet. And you'd realize that this was a kid who was really going places, that like something amazing would happen to him if he didn't die of scurvy first.
I learned of Aaron's death. In fact, in Boing Boing, in your very moving piece about him.
Thank you.
And then of course started to read more and more Larry Lessig and just the outpouring.
Yeah.
Did you go to the funeral? Is the service?
I did. Yeah. So I got the word that Aaron had died while I was in Toronto. My wife had gone home from our Christmas holiday early to get back to work. She's running a startup, and I stayed on with my daughter so she could have a little more time with her grandparents. And a couple of days before we were to leave, I got the word. My wife called me from London and said that our mutual friend, who was also a friend of Aaron's, Quinn Norton, had come over to our place. She was visiting and with the news. And when they announced that the funeral was going to be a couple of days later in Chicago, I bought a ticket from Toronto to Chicago and I flew over. And then I flew back right after the funeral. I didn't get to go to the Shiva house. I went straight back and met my parents at the airport with my daughter. And we had a ticket we couldn't change to go back to London that night. So that's what we did. And it was really, it was a terrible way to get back in touch with so many old friends, as funerals so often are.
Yeah.
But it made me realize that I was about to go out and speak to thousands, if not tens of thousands of people in person about this book that Aaron had helped me write, because he didn't just write the afterword. There's a bit in the book where I describe a kind of next generation political campaign where someone gets elected without a party machine and without major donors to whom he would be beholden after taking office. And I wrote to all these different campaign strategy people to see how they would run something like that. And they all had like answers that were kind of inside Beltway, inside baseball, inside the box. But then I wrote to Aaron and a couple hours later, he fired me back like a full-on design document for a thing that he called a machine for getting votes, a system for getting the vote out without a lot of money, without a party affiliation, just based on the principles of the candidate. So the candidate would owe nothing to anyone except for the voters. And it was so good, like it was shovel ready. I pasted it straight into the book, except for the last two sentences, which were, I got to go. I'm going to go build this now. And that's in there. That's in the book. You know, it made me think when I thought about that I was going to have to go out on tour with this book and talk to people about how I came to write it and what Aaron had contributed to it. And the thing that I say now when I talk about this is that all of the things that Aaron did, he did not do any of them because Information wants to be free. You know, I had a long, intimate heart-to-heart with Information, and it confessed to me that the only thing it wants from us is for us to stop anthropomorphizing it. You know, people do want to be free. And the projects that Aaron embarked on and the stuff that we talk about in the book, those are ways that you make people more free with information. Like when Aaron liberated $1.5 million worth of course files from the proprietary PACER database and put them into the open recap database, that made people more free, because knowing what the law is makes you more free than someone who doesn't know what the law is. And when he went after the JSTOR database of all those scientific articles that describe the world as best as we understand it, presumably with the intention of making them more widely available, he was doing it because people are more free if they know the truth of the world. And, you know, when we pass laws that prohibit circumvention, that prohibit taking apart devices to see how they work, we make it impossible for security researchers to discover their flaws and tell us about them, so we can know whether our devices are betraying us or listening to us, whether they're doing what the Bundestrojaner did, or like many other examples I could name of lawful interception gone wild, where or other institutions have spied on people using their own equipment and they didn't know about it and didn't find out about it until the other side slipped up. And really what we want is for hackers and for researchers to know that if they take apart a computer, if they decompile it or reverse engineer it and that it is some way betraying its owners, that they should be safe in disclosing that, so that we can all know whether our devices are safe or not, and not worry about facing legal repercussions.
It's very fitting. The last words of the book are Aaron's words in his afterword. He says, now that you've read this book and learned how to do it, you're perfectly suited to make it happen again. He's talking about COICA and later SOPA. That's right. Now it's up to you to change the system. And then he says, sadly, let me know if I can help. Although, ironically, I think in many ways his death did help. You can't rationalize it, but yeah. I think it did,
you know,
it did galvanize some people to get to work.
It's true, but you know, if that's why he, I don't think that's why he did it, but if that's why he did it, then I disagree with him on tactics.
Yeah, I don't think that's why he did it,
and one of the other things I've been talking about with this book is the fact that, you know, people get depressed more than we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
People can be so depressed that they're idle. And many of us have felt that way at one time or another. And, you know, there are legitimate reasons to feel that low. You know, you don't have to be facing a 35-year prison sentence to feel that low. And I felt that low. But you know, the one thing you can be sure of is that if you're dead, you won't solve your problems. Dead people don't do anything, right? They don't solve problems. You can't iterate your way from death. You can't go, well, that didn't work. What else can I try? And, you know, our networks allow us to know so much about one another. You can use your network device to find out, you know, where your friends are by looking at their Foursquare, by looking at what their Instagram, you can know what they're eating. By looking at their Facebook, you can know what they're talking about. But you shouldn't assume, unless you've asked them and unless you've listened very carefully, that you know what they're feeling. And we can, just as we use devices and make devices that make us more free instead of devices that take our freedom away, we can choose to use our devices to take care of each other instead of allowing our devices to atomize us and to alienate us.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes an affirmative choice. It takes not just using Twitter to trade bon mot and not just using Facebook to kind of talk about what's going on, but to actually ask each other using our tools how we're feeling and to listen carefully.
Boy, that's a great message. I don't know. I agree with you 100%. You know, we actually were having a similar conversation on our last show on This Week in Google about Google Glass, and it could go both ways. It could be used to separate you, to put up a wall between you and the world, and social media often is used that way. But it is an opportunity to do the opposite, isn't it? To connect.
Yeah, I think that, you know, technologies have affordances that kind of the way they're used, but those affordances are designed in or designed out according to what we say we want to do with them. And we can, you know, we can socialize, for example, on the internet. We could find a way of socializing without allowing a thug in a hoodie to affect a man in the middle attack on the whole of human civilization if we chose to. And you know, I think we should choose that. And I think that, you know, it's up to technologists to build the services and tools that let us do that. But it's up to us to also value systems not just for how well they work, because Facebook works very well, but how badly they fail. And Facebook fails very badly in that it causes you to so systematically undervalue your privacy.
Right.
You know, if you want an example of that, add up the market cap of Facebook divided by the number of users they have and realize that all of your disclosures to Facebook together are worth mere pennies on the market.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me, you in everything we've been talking about, they're polar opposites. It's a dark and a light. There's open and closed. There's dystopia and a utopia. There's back doors and there's freedom. Do you see the world that way? Is there this kind of polarity between those?
Is it binary?
Is it binary? Is there a polarity between people who want to control us and freedom? I mean, it sounds binary.
I don't think it is. You know, here's what I think. We do today involves computers, and everything we do tomorrow will require computers and the internet. And as a result, every problem we have involves computers. Not because computers cause the problem, but in the same way that they all involve clothes, right? You'll often hear after killer played video games. But,
right.
You know, if the killer is like between 4 and 50,
yeah.
The remarkable thing would be that he didn't play video games, right?
Right.
And in the same way, computers are are somewhere in the middle of every problem we have because computers are in the middle of everything we do. But there's this impulse to solve, and I think it's sometimes an honest impulse to solve a problem by changing the computer. By mandating that computers be designed to run every program except for the one program that pisses us off.
Right.
And the problem is that we don't have a model for that. Our closest model to that is the spyware, right? The I can't let you do that, Dave program that lurks in your computer waiting for you to do something prohibited and then kind of leaps to the fore and prevents it. And it's not so much that everybody wants to control everything we do. It's that there is often a kind of depraved indifference to the consequences of what we do. So take, for example, the fact that governments in the name of electronic surveillance, or espionage, which sometimes they call cyber war, although I think conflating surveillance and war or espionage and war is a bit silly. Mike Masnick wrote about this morning. He said, espionage is what you do so you don't fight wars.
Mm.
But electronic espionage and sabotage has led governments to start buying zero-day vulnerabilities on
right.
the open market. So
right.
the U.S. government and other markets, they buy bugs that have been discovered in software that have not yet been reported to the manufacturer, because those bugs can be used to break into the computers of people who they want to do something bad to, who they want to watch. And so one of the bugs that are most highly treasured are embedded system bugs, because that's the thing that lets you write viruses like Stuxnet that go after nuclear reactors and so on. And so embedded system bugs are very likely now, if they're discovered, to be hidden instead of disclosed. So they're never patched.
Right.
Now that matters, because embedded systems are implanted systems. The computers that we put in our body run embedded operating systems. So for example, Barnaby Jack gave this presentation in Australia last November about implanted defibrillators. And he showed that he could detect the wireless signal from your implanted defibrillator from 30 feet away, and that he could reprogram your implanted defibrillator to serve as a viral vector to seek out other implanted defibrillators and infect them, and then to deliver lethal shocks at either a set interval or sometime in the future. And, you know, those bugs will exist in our embedded systems, and I think we all want the incentive for everyone who discovers those bugs
yeah.
to responsibly disclose them so that they get patched
yeah.
and not to be kind of turned into something that is a valuable commodity by the NSA because they want to be able to run, you know, James Bond spy scenarios of shutting down nuclear reactors with Stuxnet.
But getting back to this black and white world, you're more nuanced, I'm sure, than seeing it in black and white. Maybe it's just easier to tell the story that way, though.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I hope I kind of get into some of those gray areas in Homeland, because on the one hand, Homeland is a book in which someone is Marcus, the main character, is in possession of this huge trove of secrets that were liberated from government and corporate computers that indicate all kinds of wrongdoing. But he's also having his own computer compromised by people
right.
who think that he's not disclosing that fast enough. And so he has to cope with the ethics of what it means to have your computer compromised, to have your computer
right.
compromised by someone who thinks that your secrets should be out there in the public and doesn't mind if it compromises you. And so in having him run through the very viscerally those moral questions, I hope that I give the reader a sense that this is not a black or white issue, that liberating secrets on the one hand can make the world a better place, but on the other hand can do enormous harm to people who don't deserve it.
Sounds like it was inspired by Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks.
Certainly, there's a lot of WikiLeaks in there, and also the Jacob Applebaum stuff. You know, he wrote the other afterward. Right. He and Aaron both wrote afterwards, and Jake is one of the WikiLeaks volunteers, and you know he doesn't leak, he doesn't help leak. He's a spokesman, but as a result, every time he crosses the U.S. border, he's detained by Customs and Border Patrol for hours and hours, and they ghost all of his equipment. They copy all of his drives, so he now travels with just blank equipment. So his phone. He says he only loads the names of people he doesn't like into his phone, and then his thumb drives, he keeps copies of the Bill of Rights on them.
Awesome,
yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah, he says, what if you could travel back through time and help Daniel Ellsberg leak the Pentagon Papers? Would you do it? Would you risk your life to end the Vietnam War? But he even refers to the fact that it's more morally complex than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the thing about that afterward that I really liked is the fact that although much of the code in free and open source software is contributed by people who are just scratching their own itches, that taken together, it amounts to a profoundly compassionate moral act on behalf of the human race to make code that makes us more free. Because especially in the world that we live in now, where the copyright wars has resulted in the passage of laws that makes it illegal to jailbreak devices, to remove DRM, it's very hard for the people who are technically capable of discovering ways in which our devices might be compromising our privacy or our integrity to publish what they find, to disclose what they find, because they always have to worry, am I going to end up like GeoHots? Am I going to end up like Trevor Eckhart, where disclosing a flaw in a system results in my facing enormous criminal and civil liability? And, you know, by having open systems out there, you have systems where the flaws can be disclosed without worrying about running afoul of the DMCA, of the anti-circumvention rules. And that means that to the extent that we use open systems, we make ourselves somewhat immune to the kind of horrific disclosures that we've seen, for example, when the school district in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, loaded spyware onto the laptops they gave to all the kids, supposedly to help them recover stolen laptops. But they used it to take thousands of photos of these kids at home and at school, awake and asleep, dressed and undressed, because they were looking for discipline cases.
Yeah. It's fun. I love it that you're a little bit of a subversive, Corey. I guess I don't have to tell you that. But I mean, this, when you say it's a young adult book, this is a very subversive book. In fact, Jacob Applebaum says, happy hacking, you know? He says, yeah, make sure you understand that there's a difference between legal and illegal and right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And the implication is that some things that are illegal are right.
And everyone who's ever jailbroken an iPhone has done something illegal, right, that I think is right. So, yeah, I think it's hard to argue that case.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that these books will be more like verbs than nouns. I hope that they'll be something you do, not just something you have. And that's why, you know, there's a series of instructables based on each of the books that explains how to build the technology that's in the books.
Oh, that's
that the instructables
neat.
Folks put together. Yeah, it was very cool. One of my old interns from EFF went to work at Instructables and got them involved in this. That's why there's the bibliographies and the afterwards and all that stuff that explains how to make the stuff that's in the book. And one of the challenges I set myself in the books was to build technology in the books, imaginary technology that was possible, if not real. Rather than writing the kind of techno thriller where all the computers go brrr, 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 as the all caps blue on white type rolls across the screen, I wanted a book full of computers that acted as interestingly and with as much excitement as the computers that I know do, a techno thriller that was really about the technology. And as a result, the books are full of stuff that you can build, that your kids can build, that you can build with your kids to hack your world, to configure your world, to make your world more the way you want it, and to make yourself more free with technology. So, plus, there's some good coffee recipes.
You talk about an AeroPress in here. Is that your current coffee brewing choice?
Yeah, when I'm on the road, I have two ways I brew coffee. The first is with an AeroPress, and then I also do cold brew in mini bars. And the way that I do that, cold brew is where you take ground coffee and combine it with cold water, and you steep it in an airtight container, and then you strain it. You never heat it up, and you get iced coffee that's beautiful. It's very strong, but not at all bitter, and very, very caffeinated. And the way that I do that in a mini bar is I have breast milk bags, and I put some ground coffee in the bottom of them because they'll stand up in the fridge, right? I put some coffee coffee in the bottom of them, fill them up with water, keep them in the mini bar overnight. And then in the morning, you can pour it through the disposable filter that comes with your coffee maker in your hotel room, right, or put it through an AeroPress, or, you know, even through a face cloth in a pinch.
This is how, my friends, you do a 24-book tour, a 24-city tour for your book.
Tell me about it. I last night after my gig at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, I drove in a car. They drove me all the way to Newark for 4 hours, and I slept in the back of the car as best as I could. And then I had a hotel room for an hour and a half. Jeez. And then I flew to Houston.
Oh, Corey.
Slept as best as I could then. And then I switched planes and came here to New Mexico. And then I've done back-to-back presentations ever since. I haven't had a break yet. And I'm going straight from this to another presentation.
Oh, Corey, I'm so grateful that you could spend some time with us.
I'm
really
so happy
appreciate
that you put me on. I'm just – if I seem a little fuzzy,
You know what? When you're fuzzy, then you're a little bit closer to my level, and I can understand what you're talking about. So, because when you're on, man, I can't just go. I just go, I'm going to make notes, and maybe in a few years I'll understand what Corey's talking about.
That's great. Nice
you're
to you
way
think.
Too brilliant when you're on. So thank you for dumbing yourself down to our level. And I'm sorry it took exhaustion to do it.
Well, there it is. All you need to do. This is the first day on the tour when I haven't had time to make my own coffee in the morning, and I think it's starting to get to me.
Corey.
I think that having my own magic bean juice is really the secret mojo.
Absolutely. Corey Doctorow, craphound.com. He's a founding editor of boingboing.net, and his new book, Homeland, is just out and for the third week on the New York Times bestseller list. That must make you feel good. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, Corey, I want to ask you, what's on your agenda? You know, once you go home and take a long nap, what's next for Corey Doctorow? And we're going to have more with Corey in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Pond5.com. Now, see, this is the right idea. It's royalty-free illustrations, photos, music tracks, sound effects, motion graphics templates, 3D models that you can use in your presentations, in your podcast, whatever you're making. And everybody's happy. The people who create the content love Pond5 because Pond5 pays the highest royalties in the business, and the media makers get to set their own price. That's great. You're getting great deals. And look at the variety. 1.5 million stock videos, 8.2 million photos, 735,000 illustrations, musics, everything. Now, there's always a free video of the week. If you scroll down just a little bit, I like that dog. I don't know what that. This week, the free clip is Ants in a Line. Now, you can download that minus the Pond5. Now, I think you could use that in your next PowerPoint. There's all sorts of things that could refer to, right? Those ants in a line. But I got something even better for you. How would you like 50 free stock media files? Music, pictures, everything. 50 free when you go to Pond5.com/triangulation. P-O-N-D, the number 5.com/triangulation. The idea here, and I think it's a great idea, is they're willing to give you these 50 free files for use in any way you see fit, royalty free, because in order to do this, you have to sign up for a Pond5 account and get used to how you browse and how you check out and stuff. And so then you'll be comfortable. And the next time you say, I really need a shot of abstract pedestrians walking the streets of the city, or somebody keyboarding, or Stonehenge, you go, you know who will have that for $10? Pond5 will have that. So just give it a try. Look at all this cool stuff you can get. Free. Pond5.com/triangulation. And if you make media, if you're a videographer, a photographer, illustrator, you should really think about Pond5 for your stuff. A great way to make money on the side with the best royalty rates in the business. Everybody's happy. Pond5.com/triangulation. We're talking to Corey Doctorow, author of Little Brother, just out. And Neil Gaiman says, a wonderful, important book. I'd recommend he's talking about Little Brother, the predecessor to this. I'd recommend Little Brother over pretty much any book I've read this year. Boy, when you get Neil Gaiman log rolling for you, you're doing pretty good, Corey.
Well, and skip down to the last one there. I've got a blurb from Judge Alex Kaczynski, too, the Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit.
Wow, the Ninth Circuit, the most liberal, in fact, the only liberal court of appeals in the United States. I'm a huge fan of Little Brother. Reading about Milky, Angie, and their friends helps me visualize the escalating intrusions on our freedom and privacy Wrought by advances in technology, this book describes a dystopia that seems chillingly plausible and near. And that's from a guy who could actually do something about it.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm pretty amazed that Kaczynski is a fan of my books. But I heard this from an EFF lawyer who was at some dinner. And he said, you work at EFF. Do you know Cory Doctorow? So we corresponded. He was kind enough to give me a quote. It was great.
That is really awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So, you know, writing has become, and by the way, we should mention that you know, talking about DRM and all of that, you've always made your books available in varieties of ways. Are these books available freely in some way?
Yeah, it's a free Creative Commons download, just like all the other books. And also, if you like it and you don't want to buy another copy, if the free book is all you want, but you want to thank me, I have a long list of schools and libraries, halfway houses and prisons where the people who work there would like a free copy. And I have their address published on my website. And you can buy a copy and ship it to them from whatever your favorite bookseller is. And that way you can sort of pay your debt forward in real time. It's very nice.
I think this is so amazing. And I think I always use you as an example when people say, oh, piracy is going to put us out of business. We can't sell records. We can't sell movies.
Right.
I say, you know, Cory Doctorow is doing okay, and he gives everything away.
So here's the thing, right? Everybody's books are available as free downloads.
Right.
It's just that with mine, you don't have to break the law to do
it. You don't have to feel bad about it. Yeah.
And so what I like to think of this as like performing generosity and trust and doing that to kind of effect a social contract with the reader who could otherwise get it for free if she wanted to, such that she feels a stake in my future and does whatever she can to make my future better because I'm the kind of guy who doesn't call her a crook.
Yeah. And that's the thing that always gets me is that the movie industry and the recording industry really believe that we're thieves.
Yeah.
That's pretty demeaning to be told that every time I go to a movie.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, there's nothing more shocking than paying, as I do in London, £13, which is, one squillion dollars to go see a movie and then be subjected to, a ridiculous.
Yeah.
You wouldn't steal a car.
So why are you stealing our movies? I just paid a lot of money. I'm not stealing your damn movie.
This is let me show you my ticket stub, Mr. Protectionist. So anyway, you asked what's coming up.
Yeah.
So the next thing that will be published by me is actually a follow-up to Homeland that'll be out in just a couple of weeks in mid-March.
Okay.
It's a novella that follows from Homeland but doesn't spoil it, so you can read them out of order, called Lawful Interception. And it was actually commissioned by the White House.
What?
Yeah, so the White House is doing this series of technology challenges with Intel's futurist Brian David Johnson, where they're putting up cash prizes, a bit like the X Prize, where you can claim it if you make a technology that's on their list of things that they want to see in the real world. And Brian from Intel, the futurist there, Brian David Johnson, is a great fan of something we call prototyping in fiction or design fiction, where science fiction writers describe how a technology would be used in the real world, and that inspires the engineers in their engineering discussion. And so they commissioned a story for me, and it's going out in mid-March. It'll be published jointly on Tor.com, WhiteHouse.gov, and I believe Intel.com as well. That's going to do a print edition.
That's one of the things. In fact, the Wall Street Journal noted that when it was reviewing Homeland, that sets you apart, which is you're of course a great writer and talking about great themes. But unlike others like George Orwell, you understand the technology. You're right up to the minute on the current technology. So it's a nice mix.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a generation of science fiction writers. It's swung around again after the cyberpunks, who mostly treated computers as metaphors.
Right.
We've kind of swung around to science fiction writers who grew up reading the cyberpunks and went off to make the technology that they read about in the cyberpunks, and as a result ended up incredibly well versed in the technology and now write about it in a very kind of rigorous mimetic way, a way that kind of corresponds to reality. Actually, you know, if I can plug it, someone else's
Please.
Book here.
Yeah.
I just a couple of days ago on the tour, I finished a book written by my old student from the Viable Paradise Workshop, Leonard Richardson, called Constellation Games. That's a spectacular computer-driven first contact science fiction novel about a game developer who, after the aliens come to Earth and build a base on the moon, sends them an email and says, you know, I review really crappy video games. Have any of the civilizations you've encountered in the last 90 million years had any video games that I might review. And these kind of weird anarchist aliens who set up this base on the moon fire a bunch of revived game systems down onto the Earth in reentry foam from their base on the moon. And he starts reviewing their video games. A spectacular novel. It's not just funny. It's also really clever and full of all kinds of great ruminations about art and compassion and politics. And it's just a wonderful book.
First contact through video games. You know, you make a really good point, because I love Neuromancer. I love William Gibson. When I found out that Neal Stephenson writes longhand with pen and William Gibson really didn't like computers at all, it was a little bit disheartening. So I think you're right. This is a different generation and one that embraces technology in a very different way.
To be fair, I think Bill just didn't know much about technology. Right. I think he likes technology. He just couldn't afford it very much. Right. And Neil was a programmer. He just kind of, I think, to save his wrists and also because he found himself blocked at the keyboard and distracted, switched to a phone.
All right.
But they're all into technology, but they didn't grow up.
It's a different generation.
Yearning to go to cyberspace.
Right.
Right. They grew up writing about.
They made it up. Yeah.
Grow up yearning to go to cyberspace.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Oh, certainly no disrespect meant at all. I'm a huge fan of both.
Bill gave me my watch.
Oh, you're kidding.
This is a watch from the William Gibson collection. How's that for a little bit of fun?
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah. That's pretty good. It's analog, by the way.
It's former Soviet military. Those red bands are radio silence times.
Oh, I like it. Now that's a handy thing to know.
Yes.
We're getting close to a radio silence. We don't want to go on too long.
That's right.
You write fiction and you write nonfiction. You were, of course, the European attaché for the EFF and all of that. It seems like you've really found your voice in fiction. Do you want to keep doing that, or are you going to what's your future plan?
Well, I've done some nonfiction too, and
I have it.
I've just finished a full-length nonfiction book, a collection of essays called "Information Doesn't Want to Be Free," and it's basically about business and the internet and how to do business on the internet that doesn't make the internet less safe or less free, and that also doesn't transfer all the negotiating leverage to companies like Amazon or Apple.
Right.
So I think it's a good book, and my agent is shopping it around right now. I got very generous introductions for the book from Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer.
Awesome.
That I think really set it off as well.
Awesome. Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom must be read. Somebody was just saying that is awesome. And there's a free audiobook at craphound.com for that.
It's the 10th anniversary this month of Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom.
You're kidding. Was that your first novel?
Was.
Wow.
So it's got me thinking, actually, that my next fiction book may be a prequel to Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom.
I'd like that.
Yeah, it'd be nice to revisit that. Like, I'd never really written a sequel before this, and writing Homeland was kind of like discovering that all my best high school friends were still hanging out together, still having awesome adventures, and were totally happy to have me come along for the ride. So I'm thinking revisiting Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom would be pretty fun now.
How fun. What is a hot-button topic for you these days? I know we've talked about DRM in the past, piracy and all of that stuff. What's going on? What do you care about now a lot?
Well, I guess I'm pretty interested and worried about the lawful interception industry. These are the companies that do deep packet inspection, that do malware, malware-based spyware surveillance technology, drone surveillance, and so on. And the growth of all of this stuff and the companies that make it and try to stitch it together and produce what amounts to guilt by accusation by algorithm, where this huge amount of data that's being collected from you using methodologies that are totally opaque and need not be any more rigorous than the ones used by the copyright trolls that threaten people with spurious lawsuits for downloading pornography. Nevertheless, then sell this technology off to governments that use it to figure out who to actually like arrest or put under suspicion or add to a no-fly list. And I'm really worried that we're entering into a system of like totally automated surveillance, accusation, and assumption of guilt.
Yep. Well, like the copy, what is that? This new CAS system, the six-strike system that they just implemented today or yesterday.
Oh, yeah. It's brutal. So after I think your third accusation, if you're an AT&T customer, after your third unsubstantiated copyright infringement accusation, you lose YouTube and Facebook. until you complete a Recording Industry Association of America designed copyright re-education boot camp. And then that, and once you pass the exam at the end that says that you fully absorbed and come on board with the record industry's weird version of how copyright law is supposed to work, then you get your YouTube back.
Horrible.
Yeah, it's brutal. Horrible. It's a kind of corporatist private law that's like half Huxley, half Orwell.
But it's a compromise, right? Because the three strikes law knocked you off the internet entirely.
Yeah, but there's no statute here that gave them the six strikes law. It wasn't right. Like there was any credible threat that Congress would pass a three strikes law. What happened was the phone companies, the cable companies, just rolled over for it. Right. They said, yeah, why not? And since we have such gutless telecoms regulation where the FCC has killed any broadband competition, once your local ISP, you know, sells out to big content, you can't change ISPs. So, you know, why would they ever bother to enact policies that make their customers happy when, you know, their customers can't go anywhere else? It's that Lily Tomlin, you know, what are you going to do? We're the phone company. We don't have to care.
Right.
You know, we've arrived at that world through the magic of regulatory capture and weak regulation from the FCC.
Kevin Marks is in the chat room. He says, by the way, one of the advantages of having your books online is you can grep the text. He says, search for torrent in Homeland to find out how to get around six strikes.
Yes, there you go.
That's all we'll say.
It's a thing you do, not a thing you read.
I love it.
Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin says hi. So you mentioned doing this thing for the White House. How do you feel about President Obama these days? Disappointed? Encouraged?
Yeah, disappointed. Disappointed's pretty good for – I mean, obviously, like, any administration is not monolithic, right? They're big and they have lots of things going on in them. And I'm not American, so I don't get a vote, right?
Right.
But that stuff said, to have a president who promised transparency, who promised to shut down Guantanamo, who promised an end to rendition, to then have that president go around and say, well, there's secret interpretations of Patriot that allow us to go on wiretapping, to instruct his Justice Department to block attempts to call – the NSA to account and the phone companies to account for their system of warrantless wiretapping, for them to have a secret interpretation of a law that allows them to affect kill lists and drone strikes on Americans off the field of battle, and to have that be somehow lawful, to have the greater use of official secrets than any government in the history of America, to prosecute more whistleblowers than any other government in the history of America is so disappointing because it's not what we were promised.
No. And to appoint a Monsanto executive to assistant director of the FDA and a new SEC commissioner who was a lawyer who fought to keep banks from being regulated. You just wonder who's in charge here.
Well, and this is why Larry Lessig's Root Strikers is so important, because, you know, we know why this happens, right? The reason that you get laws that reflect the interests of large, wealthy corporations is that to get elected, you need a lot of money. And the best way to get a lot of money is to ask rich people for it.
Right.
And the best way to get them to continue giving you money is to pass laws that make them richer. And they get to use that money to get you reelected. Lather, rinse, repeat. And three or four election cycles later, it's a felony to find out whether or not your phone is spying on you. And so you know, Larry says we've got to get the money out of politics. We've got to fix campaign finance. And being a constitutional lawyer, he understands that anything that will raise a constitutional challenge is probably a no-go. So he's not saying, oh, well, let's bump off a few Supreme Court justices and get rid of Citizens United. Instead, with his rootstrikers.org, he has proposed that we issue vouchers to the general public that allows them to contribute directly to political campaigns, but that any politician who takes public money, voucher money, for their political campaign can't take PAC money. So that the optimal strategy to get elected is always to please as many voters as possible, not to suck up to as many large rich corporations as possible. And I think that that's a remarkably outside-of-the-box way of solving this problem. You know, I think that it's pretty credible that lawmakers might vote to get more money, right? Because that's what you're asking them to do here. And I think that having done that, we may be able to start fixing this.
Yeah, I thought it was really telling that Larry, who for so long was fighting, you know, the record industry and DRM, realized, you know, you're not going to make any headway in any of this stuff until you restructure how we elect officials.
Yeah, we were talking about broadband policy before, and one of the examples that Larry cites is North Carolina, you know, which has the Research Triangle, and their economy is very dependent on high tech. But North Carolina has, I think, the second or third worst broadband in the country, and their state government passed a law prohibiting municipalities from competing with the phone companies that have given them the second worst internet service in the country, right? Why would you do this unless you were, you know, responsible to the phone companies instead of responsible to the voters?
Yeah.
You know, there are places where there is no broadband, but it's against the law for the city to provide broadband.
It's just it's amazing. It's a little bit rigged, too, because, of course, the people in power do everything to stay in power. And the system that works to put them in power is very difficult to change, because the people who get to change it are the ones who are benefiting from it.
Well, that's why I like Larry's suggestion, because basically you're only asking Congress to give themselves more money.
Yes.
And I think that you can sell that.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that there's lots of Congress people who would prefer not to have to be lapdogs.
I agree. I think that they don't necessarily – they get into it for altruistic reasons, but then the reality of the situation impinges. Corey, we're going to let you go. You're so great. It's always great to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
A man full of ideas, a great writer. You got to read Home. This is subversive stuff that's going to get in your kid's library. How about that? And prisons and schools all over the country. And more power to you. Homeland, the name of it, sequel to Little Brother. Read both. And craphound.com is Corey's personal page. And, of course, boingboing.net. Great to see you, Corey. I hope you get some rest sometime soon.
Thank you, Leo. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'll get to sleep next week.
Good. I'll sleep when I'm dead. Thank you, Corey Doctorow. Take care.
See you.
We do Triangulation every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. Tune in, because it's always fun. Normally, I give the chat room more. Well, I brought you into the conversation a little bit, but gosh, when I can get Corey to myself, I'm going to keep him to myself. That's always the problem. We've got more great guests coming on Triangulation. Make sure you watch every Wednesday. And if you can't watch live, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, and that's 2300 UTC, I think, something like that, on twit.tv. Do download on-demand versions available after the fact, audio and video. Always Creative Commons, always free at twit.tv. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.